Are you a health professional, educator, executive, or diversity, equity, and inclusion professional seeking to increase diversity within your field or profession? Then this episode is for you.
Welcome to the Empowerment Zone with Ramona Houston, where we zone in on Black and Brown relations and our journey to empowering our communities.
Today, I'm talking to Dr. Catherine Ortega about the health profession and the pathway programs she has helped to develop in order to increase the number of underrepresented groups in the health profession. Although our conversation centers on health and wellness, the strategies and tactics she shares may be valuable to any industry. Dr. Ortega is a faculty member at the University of Utah and a physical therapist and athletic trainer. She is committed to working in communities to promote change for better health and quality of life. Enjoy our conversation. See the show notes for more information about Dr. Ortega. As always, make sure you subscribe to the Empowerment Zone podcast and give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. Your support will make sure that we continue our journey in empowerment and impact. Hi, today I have Dr. Catherine Ortega with us today. Hi, Dr. Ortega, welcome to the Empowerment Zone.
Thank you, Ramona. Thank you for having me. Please feel free to call me Kathy.
Sure. Kathy, it's great to have you on the Empowerment Zone and to talk about the importance of health and helping people in underrepresented groups to really get into the health profession. And as you know, here on the Empowerment Zone, health and wellness is one of our foci. We believe that health and wellness is extremely important to the empowerment of individuals and communities, because you cannot do impact work if you're sick.
That's right. That's right. You got to be healthy.
Yes. Yes. I was listening to Congresswoman Maxine Waters one time when I was at a conference years and years ago, and she stated that God needs healthy soldiers, can't have any sick soldiers out there. So I'm glad to have you here to talk about the importance of health and wellness and how important it is to get people in underrepresented groups to pursue careers in health and wellness, because as you know, cultural competency is so important to health. So can you tell me a little bit about yourself and where you're from and how did you evolve into a career in the health profession?
Sure. I'm a Tejana, born and raised in San Antonio, Texas. And within that, come from a family of, you know, six kids. Parents were migrant workers and sharecroppers. So really people from the Texas area, Texas community. We all ended up pursuing college. And I guess it was, you know, one big sister, one big brother kind of mentored the next one and the next one and the next one. You filled out the forms, you went. And so all of us got a degree. And when I was in school, we all played sports and just, you know, were active, too busy to date, I think, might have been, you know, so in doing that, you get injured. And in doing that, I realized that there were these, you know, professions of people that would come out and help and do something, you know, so in looking across, you know, you're in high school, what are you going to do for your career? At one point, I was going to study Latin American studies at Brown University. I was going to go, you know, do all these things. I ended up looking into athletic training, which is a sports medicine kind of specialty. And it was a mentor just in the athletic department, a white Caucasian lady that taught arts, but also was doing sports. And she was the first person that taught me that you could do both. So she had this magazine and said, hey, have you seen these programs that have this sports medicine thing? So I ended up looking there. I got a scholarship, went up to Purdue because one of my older sisters was up at Notre Dame, Christine. Mm. And I thought, gosh, if I'm leaving town, I'm going where I know somebody.
And that's a long way from Texas.
It sure was. It was New Mexico or that one. But just kind of how things happen. You know, you make these decisions and you don't really know where you're going, but you just know kind of what you want to do. So mm-hmm. it was the best decision. That's where the profession of athletic training started, was at Purdue. Who would have known?
Right.
And was a really good decision as far as being set up to network and future avenues, but did that. And, you know, then went to West Virginia for a graduate degree because that was paid for because of the connections at Purdue. So mm-hmm. did that and then came back to Texas, got a physical therapy degree and started working. And I always knew that I wanted to work with elite athletes. So I got a job in pro sports. But at the time, the only profession that was hiring women for pro sports was tennis. Wow. So I ended up working pro tennis. I mean, I applied to all the governing bodies of sport, football, basketball, baseball, you name it. And they would not hire women. So I went, and even though all the guys that were in my cohort from Purdue and West Virginia, all of them got pro jobs, Dallas Cowboys, Miami Dolphins, you know, all of those, they weren't hiring women. So anyway, again, the best thing I ever did, you know, ended up traveling the world to all the tennis tournaments because the tennis follows the sun. So mm-hmm. we started in mm-hmm. Australia, we go through France, you go everywhere. mm-hmm. You know, in later years, my male friends would kind of visit my house and I had on my calendar, you know, where I was and they're like, all right, your calendar says Paris and Prague and Rome. My calendar says Cincinnati and Miami. You know, the places that they were traveling with their teams, you know. So just in being able to do that, I was able to just see the different ways that health is manifests around the world and the health professions, the difference in the costs. You know, I mean, every time we went to Australia, we'd look down, do I need anything that has to be MRI'd or scanned? Because it's only $100 here. It's $2,500 just to get your knee looked at, you know?
Yeah.
So just a really good perspective and got to see how careers and people are different, but even more importantly, how we're really all the same, especially with regard to education. You know, a lot of things that we thought were so different, it's like, you know, we really are kind of doing the same thing just with cultural perspectives, you know, regional differences. And so in coming back home, if you will, I ended up getting my doctorate at UT Austin. And the biggest reason that I did is here I was working with these elite athletes because I work, you know, in pro sports and I also work with the U.S. Olympic Committee, the International Committee. So again, these people that are just pushing the boundaries and, you know, doing all this physical activity and trying to hold them back, you know, and give them direction to slow down, calm down because you need to get better kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then I lived in the second fattest city in the United States. You know, and I was really thinking about that difference there. You know, why is that tension happening? And so I really went to get my doctorate to study motivation. And that's a thing with physical therapy and athletic training. You can go and do more and learn more about the body and the joints and measuring motion and all this kind of stuff. Or you could learn more about behaviors and attitudes. I mean, you know, it was kind of that crossroads. And I decided I wanted to answer this question. And I remember asking one of my sisters, Christine, actually, you know, I'm seeing this commercial, how they're trying to persuade people to do something. You know, you're in marketing, you do this. How do you do that? And I remember her talking about that. Oh, you can adjust perceptions. You can adjust attitudes. And I thought, what? I want to learn about that. Why do some people, you know, almost, you know, tear their joints and ligaments because they're so driven to perform. And then these other people can't get off the couch, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of why I went to get my doctorate. And it really informed actually the way I practice, the way I treat patients, but it also opened another avenue to get into education. So I was recruited by University of Texas there in San Antonio, the medical center. I was in the gym and one of the faculty members that had been one of my clinical teachers walked by and he says, hey, what are you doing these days? And it, you know, just like that, you know, I ended up getting recruited. I got hired. I said, I'm still trying to get my doctorate. I don't want a real job because I want to finish. And if I get a real job, I feel like I'm just going to get too comfortable.
Yep.
So, you know, dumb thing. I wish somebody had advised me. They brought me on at 50% salary and 100% job. Mm. Well, when you finish your doctorate, we'll give you the rest of your salary. Okay. Meanwhile, I'm teaching 4 courses each semester. And I'm like, wait a minute. mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I finished my degree, and you know, I ended up being a tenured faculty member and ended up running the department. I was the chair of the department there in physical therapy in San Antonio. Wow. For a good number of years, until I then took this position where I am now. I'm at the University of Utah as a expansion program director. But my time as a faculty has still included clinical practice. You know, I'm a clinician at heart, but I also teach in the area of physical therapy and sports medicine. And with that, you have to do, as you know, research in the community. And that's been my perspective, is really looking at engaging the community and promoting, you know, some of the community health endeavors when looking at back pain or looking at movement with elders and people with chronic pain. But in doing this, you start to see things, right? You start to see circumstances. And I remember, you know, the initial days there at the university there in Texas, I'd walk along the hallway and you have all the graduates from the program. I was like, wow, these pictures, you know, beautiful people, nice, but they're all kind of white, aren't they? You know, just walking up and down the hall. Mm-hmm. And we had a really good, when I was hired, a really good program director chair that was becoming intentional about recruiting students that from South Texas, because we were in South Texas and we served the citizens of Texas. And so we really started to make efforts to go to the Valley and go around San Antonio and recruit more intentionally and just increase the percentage of students of color that we had. And it really made a difference because we went from, you know, 1-2%, you know, Latino, Latina kids to, you know, where we ended up, which was more like 40%, which more closely reflected San Antonio. As you know, that's a 60%, 70% population of Latinos. And similarly, the African-American enrollment of students better reflected San Antonio. So that's where I kind of started to see, we can do this, we can make a difference, but you really do have to be intentional. And so that's where the idea of some of the pathway programs that I've been working on came from, is, well, we almost stumbled upon it, that this is what we needed to do. And luckily there at the Health Science Center, we had some deans in the past when I was there who really were committed to this. And so we were able to apply for huge grants that enabled us to put programs together. And so the most recent program was we called it a student tailored educational pathways, but it was a STEP grant. And it was multifaceted in that we put together a peer mentoring program. We put together student learning communities. So almost putting together students' support systems so that they remained in our programs, but also went out to recruit, went out and did immersion activities to let students know what the different healthcare professions were, not just physical therapy, but respiratory care and medical lab technology. So it was kind of a group sort of grant. You know, they used to call these sort of programs pipeline programs. You know, that's kind of been the older term. And I think the reason that it's been replaced with pathways is pipeline just denotes passivity. You know, you're pushing this stuff through this pipeline as opposed to a pathway that shows people how to go and gives people choice and moves people along. So I think pathway is the more current term, but really this is kind of where my passion has developed between pathway programs and also community health programs, interventions is what I've been doing. I'm here in Southern Utah right now. And the reason that this program is here at all is it's an expansion of University of Utah in Salt Lake City, but they're expanding to Southern Utah because it's similar to South Texas, where the healthcare is really sparse. There's a lot of rural community. There's not a whole lot of healthcare professionals that look like the community. And so it really is an expansion of the mission to bring healthcare and decrease the disparities in healthcare in this part of Utah, the southern part of the United States, really. So we're really looking at reaching out to the Native Americans, the indigenous community, but also there are Latinos here, you know. I'm in this town called St. George, and it is 65% Caucasian, but I had to get a place to live, so I'm kind of cheap on some areas, so I went to a thrift store, you know, a little piece of furniture or something as a desk, and I walk in, and right, you know, above the door is this sign that says bienvenidos in Spanish, you know, and I'm like, wait a minute, you know, the greeting. And then under that was an Asian language, some writing. That's what I said. I was like, why is there a thrift store here in this almost 70% Caucasian town with this sign up here? And I start looking around and, you know, I noticed just a couple of people of color. But then when I turned around and looked at the parking lot, right across the parking lot was the church. And it was this, you know, Roman Catholic church, but around the church was the elote, you know, the street corn and the, and I mean, it was just so stereotypical, but the mariachis and the raspa. And I was like, here they are. You know, and I went up and just started looking around and I'm like, oh my gosh, but it's one block off of Main Street of this white town. But if you didn't know they were there, you would miss it. And then if you went up the road, it came to a T and there was this big store called Tres Amigos, you know, the Three Amigos store. And it was a Mexican market, a South American market. And I thought, I have been passing this place for 3 months and I never saw it, you know? So it really kind of got me thinking, there are communities here. We just have to find them because people are kind of, you know, in their own siloed areas. And so that really gave me a bit of hope because I was thinking, well, you know, St. George, good luck trying to find some, you know, diversity here. But people are here, you know, and I do go across campus and there are, you know, African-American students, you know, and I'm really cautious about don't run after them and say, where are your people? But, you know, trying to engage with students to figure out, you know, what do you do? Where are you? You know, how can we help you? You know, and how can we find more students to bring diversity to this campus and ultimately to the profession? You know, so a long way around to say, this is my path. This is where I am right now.
I loved hearing about your journey, and it's amazing how life takes us on all these different pathways, just to use your term, path. And looking at going into physical therapy and you being a woman and more so a woman of color and could not find a job in your profession, but yet that setback was a set up for something even more impactful than you ever imagined, being able to travel the world and being able to work with professional athletes in different environments in different countries to see how culture shapes health and wellness and how culture, depending on what country you're in, also determines how much it will cost for you to be healthy. To your point about going through school and first exploring how the body operates and then transitioning to see how behavior and attitudes determine how the body operates because you make choices about your health. I have a question. What did you discover in your research? You know, like you said, you work with these top athletes, and then all of a sudden you're working in a city, San Antonio. I hate to say the name to say that they're the second, how did you put it?
Fattest city.
I didn't want to say fat, but that was the truth, you know. So what did you find out about the perceptions and attitudes which shape behavior, health behaviors? And like you said, your messaging, what you decided to do to try to help people who are suffering from obesity and all the other health issues that are caused by obesity.
You know, it was really interesting, all those years, all that dissertation, all that stuff. And it came down to probably what you learned in seventh, eighth grade, or maybe even somewhere in high school, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, motivation comes down to that. You know, those level of needs where the lowest level is the physiological, you know, you have to meet your physical security needs. And then you know, the next level is your societal, your social needs, you know, and upward till you get to that, I'm doing it for altruism, self-actualization. But really what motivates people ultimately is goals, right? Goals are what motivate people. And the goals have to be internal, goals have to come from people. But how do you get there? You have to figure out what somebody needs. If you can and this is my book, so don't tell anybody, but this is my book. If you figure out what somebody needs, then you know what their problem is. And if you flip the problem, that's their goal, right? So you just got to talk to people and find out, what is it you need, Mr. Martinez? Oh, you just had the surgery. You need to get up and get to the bathroom in your house. You need to do that. Why don't we make that a goal? Why don't we make it a goal that you're able to get up out of bed and stand by yourself? Let's make that a goal. And then we will eventually make the goal to get to the bathroom, right? So that you can have your independence. So because his problem is he can't move without pain right now, you know? So it's basic, but it's true. And the thing is that when you talk to people about goals, straight up, goals are scary. You know, goals are big. I mean, they kind of put people off. But one of the things that you learn as a healthcare provider is to make those goals attainable. You make the smaller goals, the short-term goals, the littler goals, so that people can start to see, oh, I can do that. They start to build their self-efficacy, you know, their confidence to do that specific thing. And then they get better and better and better, and then they get to their goal.
I love that because most of the time we look at the big picture, the real big picture, which can be overwhelming, even no matter, no matter what goal you're after. And really, it's really about taking that step, even if it's a baby step, taking a step every day to be able to stand out of a bed is an accomplishment for you that day. Let's work on that first. Let's see if we can do it 7 days in a row. And then we'll move up to taking two steps toward the restroom and moving it and moving. I love it because so many times we just get overwhelmed by the bigness of the goal that we don't do anything. I know when I had surgery, my doctor told me, you need to walk every day. And I was like, are they crazy, to be able to walk? And they say, even if it's a few minutes. So when I got home and was doing the rehab, I would walk 5 minutes in the morning, 5 minutes midday, and 5 minutes in the evening. And wow. I was absolutely overwhelmed by the fact that each day I could see improvement. I couldn't believe it. I never thought that walking could be that valuable, you know, because I'm a hard exerciser because I used to be very big. I used to be obese one time in my life. And so I have made health a part of my lifestyle. Mm-hmm. But by walking every day, I can truly testify in 10 days, every day in 10 days, I saw an improvement. Until I was able to walk 10 minutes and then eventually go outside and walk around the cul-de-sac. And eventually after 3 months, being able to ride a bicycle, but it was only after one day at a time. And so many times we just look at the big picture. And I'm so glad you shared that you have to find out what people's needs are and then flip those needs into goals, but more so attainable goals where people are not overwhelmed. What is the name of your book? Because we want to put your book out there. Okay. Well, when you write it, you make sure you come back to the Empowerment Zone so we can encourage people to read the book, because health and wellness and setting those attainable goals are so important. So can you talk for the last few minutes that we have about, you talked about recruitment being intentional and being intentional about pathways to careers in health and wellness, and replacing that term pipeline to pathways, because there's pipeline, like you stated, is just this one tunnel vision, whereas pathways is a lot of ways you can get to the same place. So can you talk about the pathway programs and what strategies, what tactics within the pathway programs that have worked for the programs you're working in? Because we have a lot of educators listening to this show, both in and people who are really passionate about education, who want to help people, whether they be traditional students or non-traditional students going to school or going back to school. So what are some of the strategies and tactics that have worked for those pathway programs?
So I'll start with one small component of it and then expand it. But one of the items that has gotten so much attention, and it was probably the summer of 2020, you know, is just the need for diversity and equity and inclusion. I think that really propelled us to more action when we had all maybe not been on that page in education. And one area that people are really looking at is the admissions process and how the admissions process has been very, very exclusive. And particularly in physical therapy, but in healthcare professions, you know, the emphasis had been on high grades. You wanted the kid with the high grade, the high GRE score, you know, and luckily I'm proud to say, at least at the institution I was at in Texas, we had not used the GRE for the last 10, 12 years because of the discrimination inherent in that exam. But still some of the factors that are used in admission are very exclusive. And so right now where I'm at, we're looking at our holistic admissions. And, you know, in one of the meetings, I just kind of said, it seems like with this admissions process, we're trying to undo and make up for all of the discrimination and inequity that we've had in our society for decades. I think we need to do as much as we can, but know that just looking at admissions is not enough, such that if you're only looking at somebody's GPA, if you're looking at the type of institution that somebody went to, like a Carnegie One institution, and looking down at somebody going through a JC institution, that in and of itself is a privilege. If you're looking at
junior college. Go ahead.
Right, because many Latinos, many African Americans, people of color start in the junior college because it's affordable. And especially now that some states are making this free, it's even more affordable. So if we start saying if you went to a junior college, that's not good enough, then that in and of itself is discriminatory. You know, and just when we're looking at holistic admissions, the push is to look at the whole person, their life experience, the diversity that they bring in looking at accepting them into these programs. And so, and there's a big question about, should we do interviews or not because of the bias that's in there, you know, but also it allows people to present themselves in a different manner besides just paper, you know? So I think when talking about that pathway, even the admissions, which is the gate, if you will, for the profession, we have to be really careful that we're not closing that gate rather than having it open. Because even if that pathway leads to the gate to get the kids into your program, if the gate is closed, they can't get in.
Right.
So things that have worked with pathway programs, I think what we know, the evidence supports that peer support is needed. So some sort of a peer mentoring program, a structured peer mentoring program where students can see that there are students that look like me in this profession, in this program, and that can speak to me. But there has to be structure there so that the students that are trying to get in or students that are in the undergrad pathway portion of the path are being contacted, have consistent contact. You know, doing the presentations about the profession, students don't know where to go, what professions are available if nobody tells them. I mean, how are they supposed to find that? Every time I go into a presentation at a high school or a junior high, I say, hey, you know, who wants to go and help? Me. What do you want to do? I want to be a nurse. I want to be a doctor. Did you know that there's physical therapy? Do you know there's occupational? Do you know that there's these other ones? What's that? You know, so then we do some sort of interactive activity so they can see what it is that we really do. But I think also with the Latino community, and I learned this when I was on the board with the Girl Scouts of Southwest Texas, you have to engage the families. People are not going to trust them with your kids if you do not give the family the information. So the pathway has to extend further down into high school, into middle school to find the families and educate the families about what the potential is for their child. Because, I mean, as you know, Ramona, it takes a lot of people to get somebody through college for the BIPOC communities. And I learned that in pro tennis. I remember one of the first tournaments that I sat at, this lady was the mother of one of the top 10 American players, blonde hair, blue eye, you know, the whole typical tennis thing. And she, a lovely lady, because she sat with me and explained the culture of this tennis world to me, which I did not know anything about. I mean, I, you know, never played my claim to fame is I beat my family in tennis, but only because I'm the only one with a racket. You know? And she said, it really takes a large number of people to develop a player. And I said, what? I said, I told her, I thought people had money. She says, even if you have money, they go through so many strings, two pairs of shoes a week, you know, and she just started talking about all this money. And I thought, oh, education for people of color is like elite sports are for athletes. It takes a lot of people to develop that person, you know? So with that pathway, you have to engage the families. And then when the students are actually coming along the pathway, there has to be a community. There has to be some support there. I think the African community calls it a posse. The Latino community calls it mi familia. You know, you've got to have people around you that are supporting you. And then you have to have people in the profession that look like you so that you can see that it's possible. You know, so some of those learning communities I was talking about, we would talk about study strategies. We would talk about the challenges they were having. And then we had socials. The faculty that were in the profession would come and have ice cream socials with the students. The mentors would have ice cream socials so students could see, oh, I can be one of these people. I don't have to be outside of the group. You know, so those are some of the basic components of a pathway, but it is definitely a pathway program. It's definitely multifaceted. You can't just do one thing and expect that it's gonna happen. We also, you know, got access, students wrote off, we got access to their grades, and so we tracked them. So we had a coordinator, and then they would track the grades. Okay, what's happening here? You need a tutor, let's get you a tutor. Your mentor mentioned you're having a little difficulty with this, you know, let's get you here, let's get you some help. You know, so students feel like they're supported and they can get assistance with problem solving along the way. I think those are big components to a pathway program, but I think the biggest thing is tracking kids, because otherwise, and that's where that pipeline analogy, you know, comes in handy too. There's leaks, you know, people fall through there, but you want to be sure that they're moving along the pathway to get to that, you know, gate of admissions and be able to get into the program.
So Dr. Catherine Ortega, we have now moved into our college strategies portion of our interview, and you have been to college and obtained several degrees. So can you tell us what colleges you attended? What were your majors and degrees? And then what strategy would you provide students to ensure that they're successful in college?
Well, so for my undergraduate degree, I went to Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana, and it was a movement in sports science major. And that was really the major that everybody that wanted to do athletic training or pre-physical therapy would go into. So it gave me a good perspective about exercise physiology, you know, components of the body, but also movement in general. And then it also gave me all the prerequisites for the next step, which was going to be physical therapy. When I went to Purdue, I didn't know that I wanted to do physical therapy. I knew the athletic training part, but when I got there, they said, you either have to do education and physical therapy, or education and athletic training, or athletic training and physical therapy. And I don't say never. I said, I'm never going to teach physical therapy. Yep. So I got my bachelor's, and then I got a graduate assistant position at West Virginia University. I got a master's of science in education and exercise physiology there. And then that was all in preparation to get all the prerequisites to go to physical therapy school, which I knew I wanted to do. And I always knew I wanted to come back to Texas. So I went to Texas Women's University in Houston. That's where one of the places I got accepted, and I did physical therapy there. And then I worked for a few years on the professional tennis tour. And that was my impetus to study motivation. And that's where I went to University of Texas in Austin. I really, truly, I would have gone closer because I'm in San Antonio, but there were no programs, no doctorate programs in San Antonio, in South Texas. The closest one was Texas State, and it was in geography. So I went to Austin, and I would just commute back and forth every day. And I got that in health education and program outcomes. One of my areas of study was aging and aging studies. So that's really informed my current work, my current research, where I'm looking at managing pain among elder adults in the San Antonio community, as well as using physical activity with aging adults. And then, of course, all the education curricula has really informed my work with pathway programs to get students into health professions.
So what is that strategy that you would give students to ensure that they're in college? Since you've attended college in several areas of the country, I'm sure you have some insight on what it takes to succeed in college.
Well, for sure, I think about, you know, get your head down, get the work done. But I also think about it, it's important to get yourself in position. In other words, what is it that is going to help you do what you need to do now and at the end of the semester for your next step? So in getting in position, it's what course do you need to take to get into that program? What job do you need to do to have enough money to do that? Just getting yourself in position so that when you have to take the next step, you're ready, or when you get offered the next step, you're ready. I think that getting in position is about doing the work, but also doing specific things that are going to help you keep moving forward to either get your degree, get this course done, get this semester done. I think that getting in position is about figuring out what you need to move ahead and keeping your head down and getting it done. When I say keep your head down, it's like, just get to work, get to work, and, you know, don't whine too much about can I, will I, should I, da-da, you know, just move forward and get it done. And then ultimately, probably what I didn't do enough of was, you know, ask for help when you need it. I was fortunate and I have a very supportive family, and I'm a middle child. So there were people ahead of me and behind me that had done things or were thinking of things. So there were always ideas. But I think if you don't have that family support, then it's really important to look around your community, your faculty, your people around you to see where can you get some support and ask for help to keep moving forward and get in position for your next step.
This was great advice. Keep your head down and get your job done. Number two, position yourself for the next step. You're always looking ahead, so make sure you do what you need to do to make sure that you're continuing to move forward. And that's what positioning yourself is all about. And lastly, make sure you ask for help when you need it. There is no shame in asking for help. But they say closed mouths don't get fed. So ye have not because ye ask not. So make sure you ask for help when you need it. All of us need help at some point of time in our life. Thank you so much, Dr. Catherine Ortega. You have been wonderful. And thank you for that great advice.
Thank you for the invite, Ramona. This was fun. Take care.